Well, we know what it's like to feel worried and helpless about the state of our world.
But we're finding comfort and inspiration from people tackling winner-take-all economics and other root causes of climate change, inequity, and global unrest.
Join us on the road from wasteland to wonderland. This is Pot of Gold.
Please keep in mind that these recordings may not be as high quality as they usually are because we're doing them in a time of social distancing. In this episode, we're speaking with Chuck Collins, director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he co-edits inequality.org.
Chuck is an expert on U.S. inequality and the racial wealth divide and is the author of several books, including Born on Third Base.
Chuck teaches us where to look for the history of racism in our current wealth divide. Healing can only begin once we tell the true story of where racism shows up in our lives.
Here's Chuck.
Well, I'm Chuck Collins, and I work at the Institute for Policy Studies. I direct a program on inequality and the common good, and co-edit a website called inequality.org. But I kind of think of our work as just exploring all the ways in which the imbalance of wealth, the sort of growing concentration of wealth and power, affects all the things we care about: the quality of our democracy, civic life, the health of the economy, our relationships, and the sort of racial dimensions of that. And so we, in the context of the pandemic, we've been looking at both how wealth is surging at the very top, how some billionaires are scoring wildly, seeing their wealth accumulate and surge. We're looking at the racial dimensions of the pandemic and how they are affecting the racial wealth divide, and also looking at the impact on charity and the need to reform charity and philanthropy to protect it from concentrated wealth and the distortions of billionaire philanthropy. So those are three sort of immediate ways in which we are trying to respond to this moment.
So when you say we're trying to respond to the moment with respect to these issues, is it more an issue of promoting deeper discussion? What's the strategy behind the approach?
Well, I think that there's different strategies, but one is that just recognizing that, you know, hopefully as we exit the pandemic, there will be another moment, very similar, I think, in 2008, 2009, when people are going to be paying attention, engaged, in a transformative moment. So some of how I think about this is we're laying the groundwork for accelerated transformation and change. And in the case of concentrated wealth, I think that means talking about taxation, wealth taxation, how to broaden ownership of companies and broaden ownership of wealth. How do we make sure we exit the pandemic without worsening the inequalities of wealth and the racial wealth divide? Around charity reform, we're actually running a campaign for what we call an emergency charity stimulus, which is to get Congress to mandate an increased payout from private foundations and donor advised funds to move $200 billion off the sidelines to the front lines in terms of the nonprofit sector. So that's very, very specifically a campaign that, you know, has a legislative dimension. So I think it's the full range of engaging people in conversation, education, and laying the groundwork and preparing for a transformative moment.
I love the hopefulness of that the pandemic will bring us transformation. You know, I hope that that also occurs. And it's kind of scary sometimes to think when you see the statistics and you see the behavior of Americans responding to the pandemic in very divergent ways. And I guess a lot of the initiatives you're talking about are really about transferring wealth. What can we say about the attitudes or the transformation of attitudes that would cause that to be a more natural thing, not something that needs a campaign, but that has us all wake up to the need for that kind of shift of wealth?
Well, Mel, I am hopeful, but I also know that things could go badly. you know, I think about 2009, there was both the Tea Party response. So there was a sort of right-wing populist or regressive populist response to that moment, as well as sort of an Occupy and the Black Lives Matter and a recognition of inequality. So, and I kind of anticipated that it'll be sort of the same. It's kind of like waking up these days where you're like, wow, look at that. Isn't that amazing? Look what these people are doing. They're coming together. There's a new moment of solidarity. And then at the same time, you're like, oh no, you know, what's happening here? You know? So, but I actually think there is this seed of an attitude change. I mean, I think first of all, we are seeing, we are really interconnected to the extent, you know, my friends in Australia, my friends in Ireland, and people I've talked to, we're having a very kind of shared experience through this pandemic. We're trying to, you know, understand what's happening, protect our health, be engaged in our communities. And I think we're having this global moment of recognition of interconnection, as well as recognizing the vulnerability of frontline workers, people who have no choice but to go to work and be exposed and are vulnerable for lack of access to health insurance, low wages. And so I think there's an awakening happening that I think as part of an attitude shift is going to be very, very important. For instance, it's very hard, I think, to make the case that low-wage workers shouldn't be paid well and that there shouldn't be healthcare that's disconnected from your job, meaning you should have healthcare whether or not you have a job, that there should be paid family leave if a family member is sick to be able to care for them, that there should be a better safety net or a decency floor through which people cannot fall. I think there's a new, deeper kind of gut understanding of why that's important. And at the same time, the absurdity of inequality in this moment. I don't want to drop too many statistics, but, you know, since March 18th to here we are, early July, the wealth of the 640 billionaires in the United States has increased over $650 billion. That increase in wealth is equal to about 13% of all Black-owned wealth. The billionaires in the United States have about $3.6 trillion. That is equal to all the private wealth owned by Latino households in the United States, 59 million people. That is the level of absurdity. And I think there's something powerful about that juxtaposition, that some people's wealth is surging while other people are seeing their health and livelihoods and lives decimated, and that we can't function as a society with that level of inequality, and that that is actually bad for everybody, including the rich. It just wrecks the sense of solidarity and unity that we need in this moment to kind of come together. So I think there's a deeper recognition all around that inequality, this extreme inequality that we entered the pandemic with, is unacceptable, and that we should do everything we can resolve ourselves and as a society to address that.
We're not talking just about racism, we're talking about structural racism. And so as humanity, we're moving from an industrial age into, as you just said, the seed, you were talking about the seed, so there's a kind of a new awakening in interconnectedness. Yet when we talk about racism, it feels we are stuck, even, you know, globally. So what has economy to do with it?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that we're seeing people in the streets responding to police brutality. But behind that, I think, is the anger of how the pandemic is playing out through the lens of race, how people of Black and Brown and Native people are feeling the greatest brunt of that. And behind that are these economic forces, including the century-long kind of racial wealth divide. So in a way, I sort of feel like, and we kind of zero in on looking at the racial wealth divide because it's where the past shows up in the present. It's where the legacy of racism and white supremacy in wealth building show up in differences in people's bank accounts, in whether they own a home or not, in whether they have access to health insurance. It shows up in the present. So, you know, whether it's looking at the, you know, 400 years of, you know, chattel slavery and Jim Crow and up to the present moment, or looking at the the theft and the fundamental extraction of indigenous people's land, and you know, it's where history is very alive, and so I think that's part of how I think the when we talk about the racial wealth divide, sometimes we think about income or the employment rate, which are important signs and indicators. But if we want to get at the sort of archaeological economic underpinning of racism, it's important to look at the multi-generational indicators like wealth. So, and again, I think we're in an interesting moment. I should say personally, you know, I consider myself having been born on third base. So I grew up, you know, in a wealthy family in the suburbs of Detroit. But when I was 1967, that was the Detroit uprising, the Detroit riots, what people called the Detroit riots. And I was a 7-year-old with a lot of questions for my parents. I remember like, why is this happening? And what's going on? And, you know, growing up in this sort of bubble of affluence in a suburb, but then living next to Detroit, my dad worked downtown, you know, we would crisscross that racial and class divide several times a month. And whether it was going to Tiger Stadium to watch a baseball game or going tagging along with my dad when he went to work. And I would see the incredible difference between my good fortune and circumstances and my neighbors just 10 miles away. So that was sort of a seed that was planted personally in me to just try to understand race and economics.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, that you... you wrote the book Born on Third Base and you know your transformation from that, and we all know that privilege doesn't give up easily. How do you wrest privilege in a way that actually causes sustained equity?
One way I've thought about it is privilege is a disconnection drug. It kind of keeps us apart, and on a very fundamental level, what we want as human beings is connection, interconnection between one another and nature. And that is the spice of life. That is the richness of life. So growing up as I did in a kind of bubble of affluence, I was really disconnected from my neighbors, from some of the suffering, which is part of the human condition. and so I actually think part of the journey out of privilege or advantage is a journey toward connection and wholeness and experiencing the vulnerability that is part of what it means to be human, you know, and the being honest about how advantage works. You know, I think that if you believe it's all about yourself, and I, you know, it's, you know, my own individual effort led to this wealth that's in my name or someone in my family, you are kind of missing the picture here of the web of interconnection and how no one does it alone. You know, what each of us does obviously matters, but so much of it is about the context and the commons and the commonwealth and the public investments and community actions around us. So if you live a life where you think you have a claim on all this wealth, you're essentially denying your fundamental interconnection with the rest of the world and nature and around us. And that is not to be human. That is, so in a way, the journey out of privilege is a movement toward humanness, of reclaiming our full human capacity, including interdependence, the fact that I need you, you need me, and I need your help, actually. Mm-hmm. And money kind of distances people and sort of denies that reality.
Our current system, our our current prevailing money system is actually designed to do exactly that, right? So we have a monopoly of one currency or several national currencies, and it's basically specifically designed. Well, first of all, it's created by a bunch of privileged people, and it's specifically designed not to be shared or not to create any other relationship other than this one purpose you can buy with the dollar. And so in that system, how can we, let's say, deconstruct structural racism?
So if we have a money system that is kind of wired as it is to extract value from some people's lives and livelihoods and from nature, and funnel it upwards, if you will, funnel it to the few, I think of that as sort of the extractive economy. And then there's the real economy. There is this economy of both gift exchange, which is much bigger than we often think of it. You know, it's really the gifts and the gift exchange that makes the world go round, not the monetary. That's one of the great myths of our time. But to the extent there is commerce and exchange, that there's, what does right relationship look like there? And that's where we can begin to build non-extractive economies, or enterprises and food systems and systems of exchange that are not based on extraction. And I think we're still learning what that looks like. But I think that's where I encourage people to like invest in that, not just financially invest, but invest literally in putting your life force toward building a real economy that's not extractive and doesn't depend on these exploitative relationships.
I'm also interested in what you're saying about discovering your interconnectedness. And I think that's something, it feels like that's something that has many points of access. You go down a pathway of, wow, everything I'm doing is interconnected, and then you start changing your behavior. Was that your experience? Like you pull on a thread of realizing that you're disconnected from your neighbors, and then that work continues to become more part of your life?
Yeah, I actually think, you know, people are always saying, well, what can I do? These economic issues, these structural issues are so big. And I encourage people to just do the best they can for starters, in telling a true story of their own life, a multi-generational story. In the case of a white person or somebody who is sort of born in my case, the top 1%, but even if you're, you know, middle class and white in the United States, try to understand the story through the lens of, okay, what was it that you did, or what was it your family did? What were the ways in which people worked hard, made sacrifices? Because that's true. That's a real part of the human experience. And then also look at the system of rules and the supports and the help that each of us gets along the way. So I know for myself, after World War II, members of my family got VA mortgages, Veterans Administration mortgages, 40-year 1% fixed rate mortgages to buy their house, 40-year 1% mortgage to buy a farm in Ohio. From a non-wealthy side of my family. Think of that. That was a substantial government subsidy that propelled a close friend of mine, same age, same income, same education, his family at that time, around end of World War II, couldn't get access to those lending programs and were in fact pushed into predatory lending programs that extracted and stripped wealth from his family. So take it back a couple generations and tell as best you can a true story about how any advantage works in your own life. And that is freeing, I think, because part of what I think holds white supremacy together is people don't want to admit that they got help. They want to believe that wherever they are there because of some quality, virtue, effort on their part. And if we bring in this larger meta picture, if you then it sort of, people feel like it takes away from them. Well, actually it doesn't. It doesn't, because the reality is none of us were raised by wolves, you know, in a state of nature. We have families and parents and communities and teachers and mentors and coaches and, you know, public health workers and people watching out for us at the playground that we never even knew their name, you know, like we're nothing without one another. And that is our human condition. And so to be able to say, I got help, I got family help, I got government help, I got community help. This person, you know, not to say that everybody got as much help as they should, but just to sort of see that piece of the equation will liberate us from holding so tightly to these I did it alone stories.
You know, yeah, I think also the notion of, I mean, one of the things we grapple with is when you have these inclusive tools where you're trying to make the economy more inclusive of more people, and to not just repeat the same mistake. You know, as we bring on, for example, an African country into the economic, you know, family, not to just say, let's have an extractive economy there. Let's bring that into a new kind of economy. Do you have thoughts about that? Like, not just expanding the number of people participating in the economy, but also as we do that, make it more conscious, make it more interconnected?
Well, I think, you know, one of the obvious great crimes of colonialism was to go to a place that probably had a highly functioning gift economy and interdependence and living closely to the land without, you know, extracting, you know, more than what we need, and sort of imposing our particular extraction economic model on that society. You know, I think that's unfortunately the lesson the mistake that keeps being made over and over again, as opposed to, like, in any community, whether it's a neighborhood, is to map the existing relationships and exchanges and gifts, the people caring for one another outside the monetary economy. I think we just don't do enough to lift up and celebrate that form of activity, the gift exchange economy, and how vibrant and vital it is. And that we should, you know, like any commons, we have all these invisible commons around us, ecological commons, the human created commons of relationships and institutions, and that there are ways to organize things. I was thinking about people who, you hear about people who have wealth and give it away, but what about people who made a decision not to cash in on whatever technology or commons they've created? You know, so the famous Jonah Salk, you know, creates the polio vaccine, says, I'm not going to patent it. You can't patent the sun. But then think about Craig Newmark, Craigslist. He creates this platform for exchange. He essentially creates a modern day marketplace, but he doesn't monetize it. He doesn't make it a pay-as-you-go model. And so he leaves all this money on the table. That's what, you know, people would say. So we should lift up and celebrate and defend these commons, you know? And when somebody creates something and gifts it to the commons or keeps it in the commons, that should be lifted up and celebrated. And we should have a recognition and status for that within the economy, because the more we enlarge that part of the economy, the less room there is for the extractive economy. It's like we're like nailing down pieces of the commons. The ecological commons. No, water is not a commodity. Yeah. Land is not a commodity. Soil is a commons. Nature is a commons. It should not be owned and extracted. We start to nail down as much of that. Maybe nailing down isn't the right word, but, you know, we create systems to manage and hold those commons, democratic systems, And lo and behold, we shrink the space in the economy for extraction. That's where a very bottom-up local community resilience strategy can.
I want to shift a little bit to the Black Lives Matter movement, just because it is so present and relevant. What do you see coming out of the Black Lives Matter movement in this time? Do you see it as, the catalyst that we really need for sustained change in America and even globally?
No, I think it's the most important movement we're living through right now. And if you look at the thinking and the program and the vision of the movement for Black Lives and some of the things that people have put out, it's very aligned with what we're talking about. It's very aligned with the whole idea of, living to live, not living to work. But the important point here is we're not going to get there if we don't understand our history, if we don't understand how structural racism has kind of warped our culture, our economy, and the institutions that we think of as normalized. So that the fact that people are not only marching in the streets, but white people are really saying, how do I understand and learn and unlearn what I need to unlearn to participate in the society? What is the history? So I think that's a important part of this movement. And I think then supporting the creation of organizations and institutions led by Black and Brown Native people in kind of the reform and redemption of the United States. And we need to have some form of reparations and repair. And I would argue that, these incredible concentrations of wealth are part of how we're going to fix that. That we have to address and redistribute these concentrations of mostly white wealth. And here's the thing that's a little tricky is we're talking about Black Lives Matter and reparations, but we've been living through 40 years of unequal economy where the bottom 99%, whether you're white or a person of color, has been left behind, or really the bottom 70% of households have seen their wages pretty much stay flat or falling. So you have a lot of white people who are like, hey, wait a second, I have not shared in the prosperity of the last four decades. I feel left behind, which is true. So we have to both reduce the sort of overall extreme inequalities, and we have to address the multi-generational, multi-century legacy of racism in, wealth inequalities as well. We need to basically understand that overall inequality and the racial wealth divide are like two strands of DNA. They have a lot of overlap, and they also have their own unique remedies. So we can't fix this in a race-blind way. We have to sort of understand that how that history has informed and affected people.
It does seem that for white people, the Black Lives Matter movement really does make that initial connection. Wow, we didn't do this alone. We really did this on the backs of millions and millions of people who were essentially extracted, right? That's part of the extracted economy you're talking about. And hopefully that's the catalyst for that mind shift.
Where do I go if I want to learn more about all that stuff, which is, I'd say, unconventional, probably not taught in, let's say, mainstream public and private schools?
The Movement for Black Lives and a lot of organizations are putting together good resource lists. There's a lot of resources out there for white people who want to understand racism. Showing up for Racial Justice Surge is a movement of white people trying to understand their own advantages. There's a terrific network for younger people with wealth called Resource Generation, people under 35 who are grappling with that. And if people are interested just generally in sort of how these inequalities show up, they should visit the website I co-edit called inequality.org. And we have a lot of data, but also commentaries and connections to campaigns. We send out a weekly newsletter that sort of tries to lift up the hopeful movements that are making a big difference right now, as well as hopefully a little bit of a sense of humor as to how we move forward. So those are some resources. And I think the other important thing is to just find a couple other people to meet with, to create a sense of support and accountability, to sort of learn together and pick meaningful actions that, because I don't think any of us can do this alone. Doesn't mean you have to join a mass organization even, but create your own little pod or affinity group of people like who want to encourage one another to take bolder steps. And I think, as we said at the beginning, I think we're heading into a transformative moment. We sort of need to prepare ourselves spiritually, emotionally, intellectually for the challenges ahead, and play a meaningful role in shaping the future. So I know a lot of us are in a pandemic space right now, but it's not going to be that way, hopefully forever. And we'll be our energy will be required to help shift it and accelerate this transition. So
let's include all these notes and research links in our show notes, including your newsletter sign up.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah,
this has
thanks.
Been really yeah. enlightening conversation.
Let's talk a little bit about Chuck's personal life, because I think he brings out a really interesting personal life story in our interview.
Yeah, I mean, I think Chuck is one of the best I've ever heard of someone who describes the notion of privilege. And what he really does very well is highlight how, if you really have an honest review of your life and the achievements and the status of your life, and you look back and you tell yourself the truth, that you did not do it alone. You did not earn it. You had to rely on doors that were opened or tax breaks that were given to you or connections that were made. And he does such a magnificent job of talking about our interdependence. And I think that's what happened for him. He was born in the 1% in a suburb of Detroit, crosses through all of these marginalized communities every day, and recognizes the interconnectedness, that he has a shared investment in life with everyone around him.
So the key word here is honesty.
Yeah, I think it's having an honest reflection of just, we are not alone. None of us are alone. There's, everything we achieve requires the input of others.
Well, it's also the honesty to yourself to see that the system is always working in your favor.
Yeah, I think that's true too. And where it's not working in the favor of others, you know, it's actually excluding other people.
The honesty to say it.
Yes. Yeah, he's brutally honest. He's obviously been brutally honest with himself, and he does it in such a way as to really inspire and enroll others in doing the same kind of hard look in the mirror.
Yeah, and that alone is actually quite an achievement.
Yeah,
on a personal
amazing.
Level, to be honest with yourself is something probably one of the most difficult things to be.
Except when you see that real happiness isn't from that privilege, it's from that connection. And that's what he's saying, that it's the connectedness that brings him fulfillment in life. And once you see that, I think the protection of wealth and the deliberate, ignoring of those connections ends, and it's no longer interesting. It's much more interesting to make connections and to give up or allow that wealth to spread.
Yeah, the conversation with Chuck made me especially think about how structural racism is so interwoven with our how should I say, it's so there that for example, by looking back in my own life, it's almost as though I don't see it anymore. You know, and that kind of conversation kind of makes me aware of, like, thinking about my own life and going through my own, for example, university life in the United Kingdom, where, and then I just got an email from them as an alumni, and they're actually pointing out that there is a racism issue within the university. And I say, oh, God, now, yeah, really great. You know, it's about time to actually point it out. But did I realize it as a student? Quite frankly, no.
Yeah, I think that is why we call it structural, is it's buried into the systems that run society, so that it's easy to ignore. And I think that's what Chuck's primary message is that it takes work on us as individuals to really see that privilege, see that subjugation, see that racism in the systems that support us in our lives. And if we have that, if we do that work and we have that honest conversation, we have no other choice than to rectify that situation.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at potofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore. Thanks for listening.